Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a new film about searching for extraterrestrial life and finding yourself.
And how the Epstein files are dividing MAGA and their potential impact on the GOP gubernatorial primary.
But first, last week, you might have heard your phone start to beep as our first official turquoise alert went out. It was for 6-year-old Violet Koltas that Hawaii police were trying to find. She was with her mother, who didn't have legal custody. The last place she had been seen was at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport. And the alert worked. She was found pretty quickly at a shelter in Cottonwood. Then the alert was canceled. But despite the success, there was a lot of head scratching about this new alert and what it was all about. Wasn't this new turquoise alert supposed to be an antidote to the systemic problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls? Koltas is white. Our own Gabrielle Pietrazio covers Indigenous affairs for KJZZ and is in studio now to explain. Good morning, Gabe.
Morning.
Okay, so Gabe, the law that created this alert was called Emily's Law, and it was after Emily Pike, whose story was devastating and went everywhere around the state pretty recently. It was, you know, she went missing on the San Carlos Apache Reservation. Her body was found. Was that the point here?
Originally, the Missing Indigenous Alert System bill was introduced in late January, so actually before Emily Pike went missing from a group home in Mesa and then was found dismembered along the U.S. 60 in the Tonto National Forest. The bill was meant to honor her in her memory, that to have essentially alert systems go out, because prior to that, she went missing, but there was no alert issued for her. She didn't have a cell phone with her, so they couldn't track her.
Right.
And so the goal was to honor her memory by making sure that no one else would go through that again. Mm-hmm. Originally, it was focused for Indigenous people exclusively and modified after a law that New Mexico had passed this same legislative session as well, which was named the Turquoise Alert. Mm-hmm. And theirs is very explicitly, as I'm reading from here, someone who is from a federally or state recognized tribe. That's exclusively the parameter, as someone who's enrolled. Could qualify for their turquoise alert, which has been in effect since about April or so.
Okay, so this Arizona law kind of modeled after that idea in New Mexico, but has been expanded, it sounds like. What's the language like here in Arizona?
After some amendments and things of that sort, the turquoise alert kept the name as New Mexico, but has broadened considerably. It now encompasses anyone who's under the age of 65. And there's other criteria there as well that can be a hindrance to some degree for law enforcement to meet all those thresholds for to qualify for issuing a turquoise alert. We heard from Arizona DPS last week when Koltas was found during media that a lot of agencies had come to the Arizona DPS beginning in July 1st when the alert system went into effect to go ask for to use the turquoise alert, tribal and non-tribal. But many of them, all of them didn't really qualify, didn't meet all the thresholds for their turquoise alert until a couple weeks later when we had Koltas's case go up from the Hawaii Police Department. And that was the first one. But many departments, as we learned from DPS, had come forward looking for assistance, tribal and non-tribal, but they just didn't meet that threshold to raise the level of a turquoise alert.
Of an actual alert that goes out to everyone. Talk a little bit about the context here, Gabe. Like when we're talking about Emily's Law and Emily Pike and this whole idea of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, this has become a big, I guess, issue, a policy point that has been difficult to tackle. What's the context there?
I think MMIP now, as we as we more broadly look at it, as missing, murdered Indigenous people, is fairly bipartisan. President Donald Trump's credited with Operation Lady Justice, which was considered to be the first federal task force on missing, murdered Indigenous people during his first term as president. And we're seeing renewed efforts there with increasing staffing at BIA offices and in the FBI, special agents to look at these cases. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland created the Missing Murdered Unit, which is in the BIA's Office of Justice Services.
Right.
This is a big issue. You have a lot of geography, land that you have to cover, essentially, where there's not as much police oversight to handle, you know, and there's a caseload that's backlogged. The BIA estimates today we have 4,200 or so missing murdered cases have remained to be solved.
Wow.
Nationwide. And so this has been an endemic problem that lately has gotten more spotlight, has been a trauma for many communities, like San Carlos Apache Tribe with Emily Pike is the latest example of that,
mm-hmm.
but is a systemic issue that's been going on for really generations. And we're seeing that alert systems like these have been implemented in states like California, Washington, New Mexico, specifically for indigenous people. And this one was touted to be that, but over time was expanded, as DPS said, to include everyone.
Right. So in the last minute or so here, Gabe, will the turquoise alert, as it's written here in Arizona and in this expanded version, still kind of tackle that issue for missing and murdered indigenous women and girls and as it continues to be an issue?
I think so. I think that it will. It just, there's the question of, will these departments and these cases reach the criteria needed for the alert to be issued? The Arizona DPS turquoise alert criteria is much more sophisticated than New Mexico's turquoise alert by comparison, if you look at the statute,
mm-hmm.
and like what is required. So I think that that's going to be under consideration.
What did DPS have to say about this first test of the turquoise alert system and how it worked?
They were very impressed and felt that it was super successful. They had received over 30 calls initially in the moments after the alert went into effect about possible sightings of cultists. It led to a quick recovery in partnership with the Buckeye Department, as well as FBI and Cottonwood. They were all responding to this case.
Yeah.
And within 6 hours after the alert, she was back in custody and is now reunited with her father and awaiting to go back to Hawaii at this point.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Gabriel Prieto-Razio covers Indigenous Affairs here for KJZZ. Gabe, thanks.
Thank you.
Maria Elena Cruz has been a judge for about 20 years, but earlier this year, the Yuma resident got a phone call that changed things for her. Governor Katie Hobbs was on the other end of the line. She asked Cruz how her afternoon was going. Cruz responded it was better now that she was talking to the governor. Hobbs said she hoped Cruz's afternoon would get even better because she wanted to appoint the judge to the Arizona Supreme Court. Cruz is the first Black justice on the state Supreme Court, as well as the first Hispanic woman. She came by the studio earlier to talk to our co-host, Mark Brody, about her first several months on the high court. And they started with what went through her mind when the governor told her she'd been picked to be a state Supreme Court justice.
I thought about all the work that was ahead, all the plans that I had thought about, all the reasons why I applied for this position, and the fact that now it's time to set those plans in motion. I felt incredibly grateful for being trusted with this position.
What has it been like for you? You've been on the bench now for a little while. What's it been like?
It's been amazing. Lots of different perspectives to answer that question from. One, my colleagues are phenomenal. I've worked with all of them in one fashion or another because I've been on the courts for almost 20 years. But I did think that it might take a little bit of time to sort of become a part of this group. They are six people who have been working together for several years now, but that has not been the case. They were incredibly welcoming. Of course, we have our disagreements, and that's why we're there, right? We come from different perspectives, and we engage in debate, but it's always very respectful. In terms of the work, well, I've been doing appellate work for 8 years, so that part is not new. What is new is the approach to judging an appellate case. That is different from doing it from a court of appeals perspective, where you are bound by the decisions of the higher court. When you are on the Supreme Court, not only do you look at what the precedent is, but how did we arrive there? Was that correct? And if it wasn't, then it's my duty to convey that to my colleagues, and if I'm not successful, to express that in a dissent.
So you mentioned the other justices have been welcoming and that, you know, you all get along pretty well. I'm interested, though, because you are, of course, the only justice appointed by a Democrat. So I would imagine that your point of view on things is not necessarily shared by your colleagues on the court, at least in some cases. How have the deliberations gone? How have those conversations gone where you are expressing an opinion that is not in the majority of the justices?
You know, one thing that's really interesting about the composition of the court is that they are not married to certain outcomes. They are not going to come out a certain way because they're of a certain political party and I'm of a different political party. It goes by issues. It's not as people anticipate, sort of the Democrat against everybody else.
I want to ask you about sort of the reputation and the perception of the Arizona Supreme Court, especially in the context of polls that show, for example, some number of Americans are maybe less trustworthy or have less faith in the U.S. Supreme Court based on some of the opinions that have been issued and some of the things coming out of there. How much is that sort of thing on your mind and on the mind of your fellow justices?
Well, there's evidence to show that the public's perception of the judiciary at the federal level affects their perception of the judiciary at the state level as well. And that in some respects is unfortunate. And what we are trying to do to change that is to be more public facing as much as possible. I think it's a lack of information about what the judiciary does, about how we arrive at our decisions, and what other programs and what other things we do within the community and for the community. I think the message that I want to drive home with people in Arizona is what function we serve. Some people aren't really clear on the fact that we are not here to make policy. We're here to interpret the law. So in that sense, sometimes it may seem like we're making policy because we're saying this is the law, but it's not based on a preference or based on sort of surveying what the public wants.
Have you ruled in cases where your ruling is not what you would like it to have been?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can't be a good judge and always rule in a way that that you agree with.
I'd like to ask you about something that you said at a press conference when Governor Hobbs initially introduced you after that phone call where she told you that she hoped your afternoon would get better because you're going to be the Supreme Court justice. And there's some questions asked about you being the first Black, the first Latina member of the state Supreme Court. Also, the fact that you're from not Maricopa County, you're from Yuma, a more rural, smaller sort of town, city part of the state. And the quote that you had was in response to a question about your background. My question would be the opposite. Why should the courts not reflect the population? Why should a state that is so diverse have a Supreme Court that looks like one racial aspect of our state? What went into your thinking in terms of A, being okay and sort of going for it to talk about this sort of thing, but also, like, I'm curious, like, what's the importance to you of your role and sort of your background being the first on the court?
So if all things are equal and you have people of all races and genders going to law school and joining this profession, and you have a population that has a large representation of Latinos and of people of color, then you would expect that naturally that would be manifested in all areas of the law, including the Supreme Court. And when I say diversity, obviously I'm not talking only about the diversity that you can see by looking at me. I'm Afro-Latina, and just to be sure, I'm 100% Latina, but I'm a Black Latina. But I'm also a person, like you said, from a rural community. And that's a very important aspect and a very important part of the representation that I bring to the court. Now, you asked about what does it mean to me? It's a privilege to represent people who may not have seen themselves represented in the past. For me, it's an incredible source of pride, but also responsibility. Responsibility because I'm sort of leading the way, letting other people know what is possible, what they can do for the community, for the various communities. And I'm happy to do that. It also requires that I be more visible
Do you feel a sense of responsibility? I mean, do you feel pressure being the first in so many of these sort of different ways to, frankly, not mess it up?
I think anybody who is appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court is going to feel pressure to not mess it up.
Fair.
You're one of seven people in the state, right?
Yeah.
And is there more pressure because I belong to these groups? I would think that from some people's perspective, yes, because there are some people who feel uncomfortable when they look at a diverse appointment. But does that affect me? I don't know. I think that if a person is willing to think that somebody's not qualified just because of the racial group that they come from or their background, I'm not sure that even doing the best work that I possibly can is going to turn those people around.
All right. That is Arizona Supreme Court Justice Maria Elena Cruz. Justice Cruz, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the history of, like, one of the most hated words in the world.
But first,
the Epstein files are throwing a major wrench in Donald Trump's airtight grip on the Republican Party. And here in Arizona, it's changing the dynamics in a very MAGA GOP primary race for governor. Both candidates, Andy Biggs and Karen Taylor Robeson, are touting Trump's endorsement in the race. But when it came to the Epstein files, Biggs, who is a U.S. representative, had a choice to make: stand with Donald Trump or the MAGA base. Well, our next guest says he really didn't have a choice at all. E.J. Montini is a columnist for the opinion pages in the Arizona Republic, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so Ed, this Epstein files thing is really dividing the GOP in a way that we haven't really seen any other issue do. Tell us why.
Well, I think essentially it's because, you know, I think that the MAGA people are quite accustomed to Donald Trump saying one thing and doing another for issues that don't matter that much to them, and they're okay with that. But this thing really did matter to them. They were very interested in exposing all the Epstein files, and that became something that Donald Trump and Republicans across the country ran on in the election, really pumped that up, were really playing to their base. And then when it came time to the point where they could actually do it, they've suddenly decided to back off. And so you now have these people who have put all their faith in this guy are saying, like, wait a minute, didn't we all say that we were going to do this? And why aren't you doing this now? And so someone like Biggs, you know, when the vote comes to, like, should we release all the Epstein files or not release all the Epstein files, his decision has to become, do I stick with Donald Trump, my dear leader, or do I go with the base, with the MAGA base, with all these people who essentially put me in office?
Right.
And he wants to be governor of Arizona, and he doesn't think he could be governor of Arizona without Donald Trump. So he's sticking with Trump and going against the base.
Right. So he voted in the House Oversight Committee against a move to issue a subpoena to the Justice Department to release the Epstein files. The vote was 8-2. I mean, it definitely, he was in the minority here. Right. Elvia, let me turn to you and ask you about that assessment of the importance of Trump's role in the gubernatorial race here in Arizona. Both candidates, as I pointed out, have gotten Trump's endorsement to an extent. How much of a difference do you think this vote could make for Biggs?
Well, it can make a big difference because we know that folks like him have loyalty to Trump, to the man, not to the Constitution and not to the American people, but to the man. And he is betting on Donald Trump still being powerful moving into the midterm elections. And so he is betting on, I'm assuming, you know, that people are going to move forward from this Epstein file, but Trump is still going to be there. And in the GOP primary, he absolutely needs the Trump support, but also, you know, Trump support needs to translate into a MAGA vote. And again, we're only talking about the GOP primary. When it comes to the general election, that's going to be be a totally different ball game. And we have seen before that loyalty to Trump is not necessarily a huge winner in Arizona when it comes to appealing to a broader electorate, when you have to appeal to moderates, to other Republicans that are not necessarily part of MAGA, and to the Democrats. So he is betting on that. And he's also betting that Taylor Robeson is not very good at handling Trump and not very good at handling MAGA anyway.
Right. So, Ed, Elvie is looking forward to the general election there. Do you think when it comes to the primary, this could really hurt Biggs with the MAGA base, or could it be an issue for Robeson to take up?
Yeah, it should be a real issue for her to take up. I mean, she should know already that when, you know, she got Trump's tacit endorsement to begin the race because she was the only one in the race. Biggs enters the race. Trump says, I actually endorse them both. Well, that's not really true. He's really endorsing Biggs. And it's particularly true since Turning Point Action and Charlie Kirk have gotten behind Biggs as well. So if I were Robeson, or if I were advising Robeson, I would say, look, you know, Biggs has Trump. You should get the base. You know, she should be out there saying, look, I know what you people really want to these Epstein files. And if I were in Congress, if I were Andy Biggs, I would be pushing for these files to be released. I mean, she's never going to be the Trump favorite in this race, and she should know that. But she could still get the MAGA people if she went along these lines. So for primary purposes, that's what I would do if I were her. But she, I think, is also terribly afraid of Trump, as is every political candidate in America is afraid of Donald Trump. Well, Republican candidate in America. And so I don't think she'll do that. And so I think Andy Biggs will probably cruise through the primary.
Elvia, do you think that this is the issue that could actually break the MAGA base? Could anything?
We don't know. That's a short answer, but it sure is looking that way. I mean, I'm very surprised that this is how they're breaking up with him on a way. But just look at how Trump has become unpopular lately. And that's because his own people do not like what they're seeing, or at least they don't like how he is doing that job. You know, take immigration, for example. You know, MAGA is really for deporting people, but they're beginning to wonder, is this a way to do it? You know, slashing the federal workforce, then the tariffs. You know, he's very unpopular with that. And Arizona is a border state, is a huge trader with Mexico. They're beginning to wonder about the tariffs as well. So all that combined could have a ripple effect, a real one. But I'm still surprised that it was the Epstein file that really riled the MAGA base against Trump.
Ed, let me turn to you lastly and ask about the other side of the coin here. Are Democrats also playing politics here with this Epstein files thing, focusing on it so much because they know that it will hurt Trump?
Well, they're doing that because it's the only thing they've got. The Democrats have been playing defense, and they're going to be playing defense until the end of Trump's term, I'm sure, because if you don't have any juice within Congress, if you're in the minority in both houses, and the president is the way he is, and the Supreme Court is the way it is, you have very few options in terms of what it is you can do to actually change the course of policy or anything like that. And so you have to make noise, and you have to make noise with whatever comes your way. And this has come their way. And they recognize at the same time that there's probably a lot of, you know, like if we really got down to the nitty gritty with all the Epstein associates, there's a lot of Democrats in there, too. Hmm. And they're just saying, like, look, we're willing to bite that bullet right now, because we know, for one thing, that there's a ton of Donald Trump in there, and we'll take a ton of Donald Trump, even if we have to sacrifice some of our own people. And actually, it shouldn't be about Donald Trump or Democrats or Republicans. It should be about sleazy guys connected to an even sleazier guy who's connected to one of the worst kinds of predation policies that exist, you know, taking advantage of young people. It's awful. And so in theory, everyone should be in favor of transparency for every aspect of this in order to root it out and try to prevent it from happening again. And so from that point of view, it's a shame that it even got into the kind of political base, but it does show you how much power politics has, even over something that everyone can agree is bad.
All right. We'll leave it there on that note. E.J. Montini is a columnist for the Arizona Republic, joining editorial page editor Elvia Diaz as she joins us every Monday. Ed, Elvia, thank you so much. I appreciate you both.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
You bet.
Thank you.
With mass starvation spreading across Gaza, Israel has come under intense pressure to clear the way for aid to enter the region. It's unclear, however, if the relief packages are reaching their intended targets or if it's too late for that aid to make a considerable impact. Joining us now with the latest on the situation, as well as some other updates from around the globe, is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. Rob, what is the latest out of Gaza?
So what we've seen in the past, 24 hours or so, is Israel agreeing to 10-hour pauses in its military operations in Gaza, or at least in parts of Gaza, in order to allow convoys of trucks to go in there and deliver aid. And that is definitely progress, although the chiefs of the UN and so on say, look, this is good, this is welcome, but it's only a drop in the ocean, and so much more needs to be done to alleviate the suffering of so many people who are really facing, literally facing starvation. Now, at the same time, we're seeing aid drops in various parts of Gaza. Jordan, United Arab Emirates, and Israel itself has been dropping pallets of aid on parachutes from aircraft. But there are all kinds of reasons why that is difficult. It's very expensive. These aircraft look very big, but they don't carry anywhere near as much aid as a convoy of trucks. A lot of the pallets end up in the wrong place. They can't be directed as well as you might think to where they're needed. And also, if you look down from these aircraft, as some of our reporters have done, of course, what you see are tents and dilapidated buildings where people are trying to live. And the very last thing they need is some very heavy pallets landing on them. There have been cases of people being killed by this. There was even reports of pallets landing in the sea and people swimming out there to try and get the food and drowning in the process. So you can see it's a complicated process. Now, all of this is happening while there's a conference in New York this week. It began today. It's three days long at the UN. It's hosted by France and Saudi Arabia, and it's dedicated to trying to investigate once again this idea of a two-state solution.
All right. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on those developments coming out of New York this week. Pivoting slightly, Rob, you're also keeping an eye on Thailand and Cambodia. Why is that?
Indeed. And they have a long-running dispute, these two countries, Thailand and Cambodia, that dates back more than a century. It's not recent. In fact, the argument between Thailand and Cambodia over the border dates back more than a century, when the borders of the two nations were drawn after the French occupation of Cambodia, you know, a long, long time ago. Things officially became kind of hostile between them in 2008, so what was that, about 17 years ago, when Cambodia tried to register an 11th century temple located in the disputed area as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. That was a move that was met with heated protest in Thailand. So we've seen arguments between the two in recent years, but in recent months, since May, that argument has turned violent, and we've now had tens of thousands of people evacuated from the disputed border area. We've had both sides firing artillery and rockets at each other across the border. We've had at least 30 people killed on the Thai side. We don't really know about numbers on the Cambodian side. They're not publicly available. So this has been a real upsurge, uptick in fighting at a time really when perhaps you could say the world doesn't really need another war. But what I can tell you, and the good news, is that just today, Thailand and Cambodia have now agreed an unconditional ceasefire after, 5 days of fighting. And this is in part, it seems, due to President Trump's intervention, because he said he would not sign a trade deal with either country until they sat down and agreed a ceasefire. Well, it looks like that has moved things quickly, and it looks like they have come to a ceasefire. Whether it holds or not, that's a different matter.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see if that deal eventually materializes. Finally, Rob here, shifting gears slightly. This coming Sunday, the new Pope will lead a mass in Rome that is expected to be quite popular.
That's true. 9 a.m. local time in Rome on Sunday, the new Pope, Pope Leo, is scheduled to lead mass for what's known as the Jubilee of Youth in Rome. That's part of a four-day event which is expected to be attended by 1 million pilgrims. In the Catholic Church, a jubilee or holy year is a special year of forgiveness and reconciliation. It's held every 25 years. The previous Pope Francis signaled the start of this jubilee in December when he opened the Holy Door of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Throughout this year, this Holy Door remains open, and the Holy Doors of Rome's three other major basilicas are also left open. Interestingly, according to the BBC diary, from various sources, they're expecting more than 30 million people to make a pilgrimage to Rome to cross the threshold of these holy doors and take part in a series of spiritual and cultural events throughout the city. So add 30 million to the already very large number of tourists that tend to visit Italy and Rome in particular this time of year, and you can see that city's going to be quite full in the coming days.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on all of these developments. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones keeping us in the loop as always. Rob, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. A new feature film revisits the infamous 1997 Phoenix Lights incident. It's called Star People. And it tells the story of two fictional siblings whose lives are transformed the night those mysterious lights appeared in the sky, prompting speculation that the valley had been visited by extraterrestrials. The siblings, Claire and Taylor, have a tumultuous home life, and in the aftermath of the sightings, their paths diverge. Claire dedicates her life to capturing photographic evidence of the lights, while Taylor gets caught up in drugs. Decades later, a possible reappearance of the lights reunites them for a frantic trip into the desert, where they're forced to reckon with their past and the other lives that have been shaped by the legend of the lights. I spoke with the writer and director of Star People, Adam Finberg, last week. He grew up in Phoenix, and while he didn't see the Phoenix lights himself, he knew people who did, and he's been intrigued ever since.
It always was a really interesting event to me in that there are a lot of ways to look at it for what it might be or might not be. I also have always connected my interest and others' interest in space, too, as having a parallel to self-discovery. It's not all just about what's out there, but kind of also helping us understand ourselves on Earth and those around us. And then the other element that led to the story was my work about 10 years ago. I directed a documentary called The Business of Recovery, which was a look at the addiction treatment in the United States.
I'm really glad you brought this up because this makes me think about what for me is kind of the core relationship in the film, which is the relationship between Claire and her brother, Taylor. Taylor is an addict. Claire is haunted by this memory that she has of seeing the Phoenix Lights when she was very young. And as we're watching the movie, Claire is wrestling with this thing that's outside of her, but feels like it's core to her ability to understand what's inside of her.
I'm here. Where are you? Come on. Show yourself.
Whereas Taylor is having this struggle that he knows is with himself. He's almost wrestling to get the version of himself that's inside of him outside.
Why do you want to do this?
Why? Maybe because I haven't done a damn thing that's memorable with my life. Never had the chance to save a life of you.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you picked up on that. That was definitely very intentional that they both had this sort of shared traumatic experience, but they both processed it in very different ways. I mean, he self-medicated through substance abuse, and Claire self-medicated through this obsession. And that actually is based on an experience I had working on The Business of Recovery. But if you don't get to the underlying trauma or whatever is causing that substance abuse or addiction, you just will shift to something else. So for Claire, it was just that she had this issue that she was just ignoring and really not sort of reconciling. And so it was kind of turned into this obsession.
One of the other issues that it seemed like you were interested in exploring here is online culture and the way that people leverage things like UFOs to get attention, but then maybe don't necessarily have a true conviction about what they're exploring. And a lot of this is embodied in the character of Justin, who's an influencer who Claire is sort of dating. We see him on his web stream talking to his followers about how he's hoping he might get to see a UFO because he's going to accompany Claire on this photo shoot.
Guys, this girl is the real deal UFO hunter, and she is going to have some exclusive footage for us very, very soon. You cannot miss it. I need you to smash the like button. I love you guys so, so much. And together, okay, I do have to go. Check the schedules. I'm going to be streaming later tonight. Peace.
Talk about developing the character of Justin and what you were after there.
You know, Justin was actually the hardest character to kind of nail down because he wasn't shared with the same experience that Claire was. And ultimately, what made sense is that there had to be a shared connection to Claire, but yet very different motivations for it. But also capturing that he was very earnest
yes.
in his misunderstanding of reality, in a way, of truth.
Yes, I'm glad you brought up the earnestness, because one of my favorite moments in the film, and I want to be careful and not give anything away here, but let's just say there's a moment where he comes to question his relationship with Claire. And he says to her, "I hope you find what you're looking for." And in the way he delivers that line, in my mind, it's clear that he has realized they're chasing different things, but that there's almost like a tinge of admiration on his part for how sincere her belief in whatever the Phoenix Lights might be are.
Yeah, the reality sort of hits the road for him because she travels the state and goes on these solo expeditions in the dark, in the desert, and, you know, he had never done any of those things.
And that makes me think about one of the other core characters in the film, which is Ricardo, who is an Ecuadorian migrant who Claire and Taylor and Justin encounter in their attempt to get this photograph of the lights.
I give all my money to these coyotes. They say, "We take you to the United States to my brother, Andre, in Yuma." They bring us to the border, and they say, "We need more money." So I give them more money, and we wait, and we wait, and we wait, and my Lucia, she got very sick. She is very hot, and nobody helped. I bury her. I bury her in the desert.
Ricardo's story is such a potent anchor for me. What made you want to have that element be part of this UFO story?
You know, growing up in Arizona, there always were stories about migrants and people dying in the desert and the lengths that people would go just to escape violence or find a better life. And being an Arizona story, it kind of made the most sense to ground it in another character who was also lost, but not lost in the sort of metaphysical sense, like physically lost in the mm-hmm. desert, whereas mm-hmm. Claire is lost in a different way.
Can you talk a little bit about the role that drugs play in the story? Because it's not just that they are a demon that Taylor is wrestling with. They are sort of this menace that haunts the entire region and that has touched the lives of the characters in a lot of different ways.
I felt like it was impossible to tell a story that was supposed to take place at that border and not somehow have that be a part of it. And as Taylor's character developed, it sort of made sense that there would be some sort of unspoken parallel because he was obviously using a lot of drugs and then there's people that are smuggling them in. There's an interesting story to be told about why they even come across the border in the first place, that like Americans are demanding them.
Right.
I just felt that that angle had to be a part of a story that talked about migrants and also talked about some of the hypocrisies.
Yes, yes. You're invoking an interesting idea there that so many people, when they think of UFOs, think of this mysterious force that we don't understand that takes control of our bodies and causes us to have these uncanny experiences, which is also what drugs do. And one of those problems we can't ultimately understand, but one we can if we would just put in the effort.
Yeah, it's a problem that is only grown. I mean, obviously substance abuse and the kind of the way we treat it, it has not kind of been taken on really by our leaders. It does kind of come back to the way we approach helping each other.
Well, Adam Finberg is the writer and the director of the new feature film, Star People. Adam, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Star People is in theaters now. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And Sam, I have a segment for you next that you are going to love.
Wait, this makes me feel like I'm not going to love it?
Okay, well, it is about a word that you certainly might not love, but you might like.
What's the latest filler that is killing conversation the most? Like. I want you to eliminate like.
And it's like, when I had this garden party for my father's birthday, right? I said RSVP because it was a sit-down dinner. But people came that, like, did not RSVP. So I was, like, totally bugging.
Like, in, like, talking stages, and it's just, like, you're, like, labeled that, and it's, like, people, like, are considered, like, you can't, like, you're just, like, confused and, like...
Okay, take this house over here, for example. You notice it's got, like, a little picket fence. It's so cute. There's, like, vines growing over everything. I don't know what the flowers are called, but, like, they're so awesome.
Okay, I think I figured out we're talking about the word like.
That is right. It's probably the most hated word in the world. And that is actually in the name of our next guest's new book, all about it. Megan C. Reynolds is the author of Like, A History of the World's Most Hated and Misunderstood Word. I spoke with her more about like and how our use of it goes back, like, way further than I thought.
When I started writing this book, I assumed that it was just the Valley Girls and maybe a little more than the Valley Girls, but that was it. Mm-hmm. But there are court records stretching back to like the 1600s in the UK that show that the word like has been used very much in the same ways that we use it now today. So in like a contemporary way back in the day. And part of the reason that the word has become so pervasive now is step one, because of empire, like colonialism. Mm. British people were saying like in that way. British people ruled all over the world for a long time. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason why it's sort of so pervasive and almost universal. But the other part is because of women, girls, young girls specifically.
Right, right. So there's a lot of gender that you're writing about in terms of how we kind of use language, police language. And
yes,
it probably has to do with the fact that Valley Girls are, you know, very much related to the word like. Like, we don't mm-hmm. tend to really respect teenage girls a whole lot in this culture, right?
Yes. We don't respect teenage girls as much, and that is upsetting for many reasons, but if for the purposes of this book, it's bad because teenage girls are women, but teenage girls especially are at the forefront of linguistic innovation and change. And it's because their speech is sort of less, like, we're not paying as close attention to it unless we're telling them it's bad. But, you know, because we're not really paying close attention to it, they're sort of learning different words and different ways of speaking from being in the world, from existing. And then it eventually becomes a part of the general vernacular, of the general lexicon.
Right.
And part of that is also because we learn speech from our primary caregivers. I will not make any generalizations, but generally, the primary caregivers, a woman, your mother.
Yeah.
That's how you learn from the jump. And so that's why it's pervasive, and that is also why it's tied to women, I guess.
Right, and also probably why it has such a bad rap.
Yes.
But you're trying to free us from that a little bit in this book, right? Like, your idea here is that this is a common word that is used in lots of kind of important ways, and it goes back a long time. Talk a little bit about the uses of the word like. Like, you even section the book into sections that have to do with the way we use this word. What's your favorite?
I think I have two. My first favorite is the quotative. Hmm. So the quotative is when you say, I was like, the cat is going to kill me because she hasn't eaten dinner.
Okay.
That That's a bad example, but it's not a bad example. Basically, what I'm saying there is, first of all, my cat can't talk, which is fine.
Right.
Second of all, what I am saying, though, is that the way she is behaving or whatever else makes me feel like she's going to kill me for not feeding her dinner. In truth, that did not happen. When we use like instead of say, what it does is it gives us the ability to communicate to our conversational partner how we feel about a situation, as opposed to what exactly happened.
Right. And everyone who was talking in that conversation would know, of course, that your cat wasn't actually telling you that she was going to kill you. But
yes,
but there's
one assumes.
Right. It's
yes.
That's a real important tool in language, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, it's the one thing that I found the word to be the most useful for is navigating any complicated sort of communication situation, interpersonal relationships, relationships that are emotional or feelings that are difficult mm-hmm. to express. And so if you're having a conversation with someone and you're saying, you know, my boss was like, blah, 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 you know, and the blah, blah, blah is like, you're bad at your job or whatever.
Right.
The likelihood, again, is that your boss did not tell you outright like that you are bad at your job, I hope. Mm-hmm. But whatever they did say made you feel that way. And so you're communicating like the contours of a story, and that sort of summary contains the most sort of like the most important bullet points. Mm. And those bullet points, in my opinion, are like how you feel about the thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And that helps the other person in turn respond to you in a way that one hopes is emotionally intelligent, or at the very least, like, fine.
So like is more than a filler in conversation, and it's
yes.
it's not indicative of being dumb, right? Which is how so many people would interpret it.
That is true. It's not a sign of unintelligence. If anyone takes anything away from this book, I would like it to be that. It's not a sign of unintelligence. I think it's a sign of sort of emotional intelligence, which, again, I think is very important. It's a sign that you are a considerate person when you are speaking to someone else. It's a sign that you are thinking about what you're saying because you want to be kind to yourself, because you want to communicate in the most effective way, you know, the way that is the most effective for you. Mm-hmm. But you're also being kind to the person that you're speaking to. So if you're having a very difficult conversation about emotions or whatever else, you know, it's probably not going to be really easy to just say whatever it is you need to say straight up.
Right.
You're going to be thinking about what you're saying. You're going to be probably making, you know, small course corrections in your brain as you are saying it. And any hesitation, you know, that hesitation can come off as like being unsure or insecure. And I would say it's not insecurity, but I do think it is a little bit about being unsure, but that's not a negative in this situation.
Yeah, that's really poignant, actually.
Thank you.
Let me ask you about your own kind of history with the word like your own experience with it. Like, having this conversation, I'm noticing how many times I'm saying
fine.
Like.
I know. Yes, it's okay.
Have you become very conscious of this?
No, I have actually felt emboldened to continue to do exactly what I've been doing for the 42 years that I've been alive. I do say the word a lot. I say it a lot speaking. I say it a lot in text messages. I say it a lot in work emails, which is an interesting. And there is a section about professionalism, because that is, I think that's like the main concern for the boomers is professionalism. Like, you're setting your kids up for failure if you are not getting them to wean this word out of their vocabulary. I also think it communicates a kind of, I mean, I think part of it is like, I'm striving for something close to authenticity.
So do you think we should all be freed from judgment for this, for the use of this word?
Yes, I think we should all, if at all possible, and is very difficult, everybody should just give themselves just a tiny bit of grace around this word specifically. Be confident in what you're saying, however that looks for you. That's the point. That's my point, at least.
All right. Well, I appreciate it very much. All right. Thank you. Megan C. Reynolds, a culture writer and editor at Dwell Magazine and author of the new book, Like, A History of the World's Most Hated and Misunderstood Word. Megan, thank you very much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was very fun.
All right, so Lauren, that was a fantastic conversation. I thought Megan was so insightful. I love this idea of like as a sign of emotional intelligence.
Thank you. I do too, especially because I think I say that word a lot.
Me too. I do have one bone to pick, though. I used to have a cat, and I think he could definitely talk.
Ah! Well, I wouldn't put it past him. All right, that'll do it for this edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. And remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radio Heads, and it is at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and his cat, I am Lauren Gilger. Have a good one. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.